You're tuned in to Rossano Radio on WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM and live worldwide at WMFO.org.
All right, how's it going, everybody? Good, I hope. Are you ready for 3 hours of nonstop commercial-free music? I know I am. Sit back, relax, grab a coffee, let go of all the negatives, and just get into music, okay? You're listening to Rossano Radio. I'm your host, FR. We're going to begin with a band called Neffex. That's N-E-F-F-E-X. And the song is called Ruthless. Crank it up, 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 crank it up. Yeah, all right.
That is your chance to be ruthless.
Hey, kid, don't ever let them get inside your head. They'll tell you what to do in life instead of everything you know that you could get. Don't let them guide your life towards regret. I'll fight for what I love with every breath. My past is filled with things I won't forget. I use them all to push me to my best. So treat the worst of times just like a test. If only I could go back in time, I'd tell myself that everything will end up alright. Just push yourself, test yourself, figure out what you like, and find your limits, don't be rigid, always work towards a prime. Surround yourself with open minds, people can change your life. A few friends with intent can help you feel alive. Find a passion, take some action, and with a little time, just be patient, make a statement, try to enjoy your life. They'll try to kick you while you're down. They wanna rise up while you drown. They wanna fill your head with doubt. They're silently scared that you'll figure it out. I'll make it look like I'm losing. Won't bother hiding my bruises. And when they finally think you're wounded, then it's your chance to be ruthless. Make some progress, I can see that they compare. I think everyone's against me, maybe something in the air. Am I paranoid? I swear a void is forming and they're scared. I walk a straight path, not many can say that. I like to play fast, cross me and there's payback. You better pray that I don't see your face at any place that I go. I know you hate that. I've been doing fine, I'm not wasting any more time. I live for the fight and the climb. I think that the pain that's deep inside is what defines. So I won't give up, I'm gonna make it to the top. I don't care what's in my way, I swear I'm never gonna stop. I could fall flat on my face and I swear I won't give back up. Cause I don't deserve a thing and the road ahead is tough. They'll try to kick you while you're down. They wanna rise up while you drown. They wanna fill your head with doubt. They're silently scared that you'll figure it out. I'll make it look like I'm losing. Won't bother hiding my bruises. And when they finally think you're wounded, then it's your chance to be ruthless.
got a lung, got a lung. She's got two lungs to breathe in the pain. She runs in shadows and the wind. It blows and blows and burns in her mind. Again, his story repeats itself in the cycles back and forth in her brain. Her brain, all the pain that she's got in her lung. Her lungs will breathe it out again. To her lungs to breathe.
Yeah.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to Rosano Radio. I'm your host, FR. And joining me for this first set is my wife, Sandra.
Hey, everyone.
And how are we doing today?
Doing great. Doing great. I enjoy listening to the music that you play. It's always great.
All right. Glad you liked it. And I appreciate the kind words. And why don't you tell the people what I just played?
Sure. So that last song you just heard was Sweet True Lies by Beast in Black. Before that was No Filter by Nefex, Sweet Self by Leah Summer, and at the top was Ruthless by Nefex. And I just want to say before I go that I had such a fantastic time at the Paul McCartney concert. He put on a great show. He's an outstanding musician, just an icon. I highly recommend.
Oh yeah, same here. Had a great time. We saw him at Fenway Park. Great light show, great set list. Really brought me back in time. Tell you, unforgettable experience.
Absolutely. And so I guess I'm going to leave it at that. I'm going to take off now.
All right, listen, thanks for stopping by. Always a pleasure to have you with me right here. And we got to do it again sometime. Hopefully you can stick around for the whole show. What do you think?
Absolutely. That would be fun.
All right, bye, hon. Big dinner tonight.
Too many people going on. This is Howard Cosell. The name of the show is Speaking of Everything. My guest is Mr. John Lennon, one of the Beatles. You remember the Beatles, who brought a whole new form of musical culture to the United States of America in the early 60s when they debuted on the then-existent variety show known as the Ed Sullivan Show. There have been many vicissitudes in the lives of the four respective Beatles since then, and perhaps none more notable than in the case of our guest today, Mr. John Lennon, who has had a wide variety of troubles and yet continuing artistic successes, all of which we shall begin to discuss with you. It's a joy to have you with us, John.
Thank you, Howard. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's great to meet you after seeing you on TV so much.
It's a treasured moment for you, isn't it?
It is. It's one of the highlights.
John, let's get right to the heart of your troubles and get those out of the way. The continuing apparent attempt by the United States government to effectuate your deportation from this country. The whole thing derives from a marijuana count against you in England, doesn't it?
Yeah, and during the 60s in England, I may as well do a bit of background on it. There was a headhunting policeman who was scoring or collecting all the pop stars in England. And he got them by hook or by crook, mostly by crook. He's now in jail. And I was one of his scalps. And I still contend I was planted. At the time, I didn't know, because I still half believed that those things didn't happen. And in England, they also had a law that said if you were in a building, if something was found in your house and you had nothing to do with it, and you were away on holiday, then it was your responsibility. So that's how they got me. And it's sort of being used to say that I can't come in. It's like a technical hitch, you know. But the government could drop the case tomorrow. It's just a matter of somebody saying, oh, forget it. Because it doesn't only affect me. There's people that have been here 20 or 30 years. My immigration lawyer told me that have been bussed over here since, say, for one joint. And they've tried to throw them out, or have thrown them out. People that have lived here most of their lives, they don't know any other country. And they ask you, you know, which country do you want to be deported to? So my case is still up in the air, and once a year they tell me I have 30 days to get out.
That was going to be my next question. I've read on several occasions, this time Lennon has to go, and yet it has not eventuated.
Well, that happens about once a year, or it seems to be once a year, or maybe twice, that they give me 30 days to leave, and then my lawyer appeals it and gives me another few months to try and fight the case. I think the weirdest thing about it is, A, that it ever started, and B, that it's costing the American people a lot of money to try and get rid of me.
How did it actually get started?
I piece things together the same as anybody else. You know? And there was an article by Jack Anderson that sort of astounded me. You know, I mean, I thought something was going on, but I was really astounded. And it seems to have started by a Senator Thurmbold or somebody.
Strom Thurmond,
yeah,
perhaps.
Yeah, that's the
from
one.
From South Carolina, yeah. Yes.
Sounds like something that happens to you in old age, so. I got Strom Thurmond in my arm. Well,
Many people have.
Yeah, right. Well, I seem to have got him in my arm, too. Apparently, according to the things that I've read, and I don't know for sure either, because I'm no detective, but he sent a letter to somebody, sort of suggesting that they shouldn't allow me to stay. And it really stemmed from an article in the Rolling Stone, which said that I was going down to San Diego for the Republican convention, which it wasn't true, because nothing was confirmed. There was nothing set. And it all started after that. And then next minute I knew they were telling me to leave. And I said, why? What for? And it's been going on for 3 years. I've been living in New York for 3 years. And I'm still here, and I don't intend to go, because I just think it's wrong. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I love it here, and they're not sending me back to Siberia.
You don't care for England.
I like England. It's my home. I like England, Scotland, and Wales, and Ireland. You know, I like the country. It's going to be there. It's not going to go anywhere. You know, but it's good to be in America. It's the center of the world, as far as I'm concerned. And this is where the music came from that influenced me as a child. And we had all the Doris Day movies and the things, and the Heinz beans. We all thought they were English, but, you know, we were like a 59th state in Britain. And I was brought up on Americana, and I feel comfortable and at home here.
It's no secret that you've smoked joints in your time.
No, it's no secret at all, you know. And the only strange thing about it is the time when they bust me, I wasn't smoking. I wasn't doing anything. So maybe that's the way the cookie crumbles, you know. I mean, at one period, people had it just out in the houses. I think they still do, you know, just like drink. And you'd go around for, if people said, they said, do you want to join? Yes, no, depending on how you felt. It was pretty open. And the only time I didn't have it is when they planted me. There was a question in the House of Lords or Parliament about it, because they used 15 men and two dogs to arrest me, you know.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, and there was a question about why they spent so much just to arrest me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they only had two dogs at the time.
I just want to spend another minute or two on your case and then get to music, to your career, the career of your former colleagues, and in some respects still. You had wanted the man who originally prosecuted you, the particular prosecutor, plus the chief immigration officer, your attorney had wanted them as witnesses for you in a more contemporary proceeding, isn't that so?
Yeah, that was about 3 or 4 weeks ago. We were in court, and I follow what my lawyer does. You know, I don't tell him what to do, so he informs me. And he said he was trying to bring in the ex-prosecution counsel, Mr. Schiano, and the ex-head of Immigration New York, to ask them a few questions, because he has reason to believe that certain letters and instructions were sent from Washington to the ex-prosecution counsel. But the judge turned us down on that, says we can't use them, we can't interview them, in fact. And
what was presumed to be in those letters that
would
serve as your
cause? I'm sorry. The whole point was, when it started, the immigration people were adamant that it was their own local decision, and it was a technicality, that it's unfortunate, but nothing can be done. It's the law. And all the time we disclaimed that and said, no, we think the instructions are coming from Washington. That was a gut reaction. We didn't believe that it was just a local case and they were just treating me the same as any other person, you know, when murderers and rapists are allowed in and heroin dealers and the biggest dealer in the world is allowed in, who's not an American. And millions of cases which we have on file of people being let in, well, that's an exaggeration. And we contended that they were getting instructions from somewhere else, and they contended not. And it turned out subsequently that we were right. But now we can't, they won't let us get at the people who would be honest about it, because they have no axe to grind. But we can't, we're not allowed to talk to them.
So the thing hangs heavy over your head, and it must be a very difficult process of living for you, loving the country, as you've already described it, knowing that the prosecution continues.
Yeah, I try and forget about it, and I try and keep my head buried in my work. But there was a period about 18 months ago, it was really beginning to get to me, because it just wouldn't go away. It's like a fly, only worse than a fly, but it's like something that just won't go away, you know. And then you forget all about it, and I think, oh, it must be all right, the lawyer hasn't called me for a bit. And then suddenly, I was in the middle of making an album, this that, out now, Walls and Bridges, ha-ha.
And, on what label?
On Apple Capital label at your local store. And I was in the taxi cab going to the record plant, where I make the records in New York, and it came over the air, John Lennon has 30 days to get out. So I just jokingly said to the cabman, okay, drive me to the airport, because nobody had told me, that my own people hadn't told me, because they didn't want to interfere with my working. So I usually get to hear about things in the paper, like 30 days. I usually read about it afterwards. And it's like somebody continually punching me in the kidneys, and it began to wear me out, but I decided, forget it, I'm going to pretend it's not happening. And I'm just acting as if nothing's going on. I just live here and that's it. And in my head, that's how I feel. I live here and that's all there is to it.
As I introduced you, and our guest is, of course, John Lennon, at the top of the show, I said that the Beatles brought an original form of musical culture to the United States in the early 60s. You nodded your head in acquiescence. Now, in retrospect, what do you deem your contribution to have been? How would you describe or define the kind of art form you brought?
I think, along with, as a direct result of rock and roll, that means Bill Haley and Elvis Presley, although Elvis Presley was the main influence, people always said we were leading the 60s, you know, and changing everybody's hair and that. And we were standing up there looking different, but we were reflecting what was going on the streets in England. And in, and here too. Well, the hair thing started in England. And what we really were figureheads for what was going on. So I never really claimed... We changed something, I'm not quite sure what it was, but we represented a change rather than were the instigators of the change. If whatever we wore was already on the street, we would just see it in a shop, buy it, or have it remade and go on stage with it.
Mm-hmm.
The haircuts just sort of happened almost. The longer hair now, which all the footballers have, right? And it's
that's good, all the footballers.
Yeah,
very
they do.
Good.
They look like, most of them look like, you know, they have 60s kind of haircuts, you know? I think it'd be unfunctional to have it any longer for them. But we were just sort of part of the scene, but we were the figureheads, you know? We're the masthead on the boat. The boat was going on it of its own accord.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just that thing stuck on the front. So I couldn't say what we contributed, you know? They say we changed the music, but we used the music that was already there. You can take half our melodies and do them in a 20s style. So it's hard to put your finger on what the change was. Maybe we were part of a movement where heroes were no longer from the upper classes, especially in Britain. You couldn't even get in a British movie unless you'd been to Oxford or something. I mean, it was ridiculous. And the same kind of things was happening in movies as was happening in music, which is people, sort of ordinary people, were getting a chance to get break in. It wasn't so bad in America because they weren't so class conscious about accents and things. But before us, anybody from Liverpool, a lot of comedians came out of Liverpool, they would have to change their voice. They would never get in a movie or on the radio if they spoke naturally. So we were part of that movement, which is people being themselves in extraordinary situations.
And God bless us all, so serious.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say you reflected what was then taking place in the society. Being a reflection, were you astonished, you and Ringo and George, by the overwhelming reaction to you here in the States?
Yeah, we're more astonished. We sort of knew what we were doing a bit in Britain, although even that astonished us. The most amazing thing was making it in America, because we thought they'll never like what we almost thought was imitation American music, which we were trying to do. And that was astonishing. But I always said that we were like in the eye of the hurricane. So we were just in this little goldfish bowl in the middle, and one didn't really have time to think what was going on. It was just going on so fast. You just had to keep your eye on the road. That was about all you could do. Looking back at it, it's astonishing that I was part of it. I was one of those things that happened, like an Al Jolson or something. You know, it's already looking like history. It is. It's 10 years ago, nearly. And it's a strange feeling to look back on it. Oh, I was right in that. You know, that's about all I can... the only way I can deal with it.
Accepting then, John, the fact that you and your colleagues, your associates, brought a new form of musical culture to the United States, whether by way of reflection of what was happening in the streets or otherwise, whom else in the past would you say were the initiators of a new form of musical culture that you would liken yourselves to?
Well, I'm more likely to I don't know about the musical culture bit. They say these phenomena, which is, I suppose, what we were, happen every 10 years or so. There was 10 years between us and Presley, and apparently there was 10 years between Presley and Sinatra.
So you would say Sinatra and Presley?
Yeah, and possibly Bing, and but it's almost more like we were the rock and roll period, which was a 10-year span of birth and formation into different kinds of music.
Now,
and
Bob
that
Dylan,
was the jazz period.
Bob Dylan was basically a contemporary of you fellows.
Yeah, he virtually made it around the same time as us, 64, 65.
When would you say his fame became international, like yours?
He got international probably around about 65, 66, when he went rock and roll.
Because
before that he was straight folk, as it were. And he was Woody Guthrie incarnated.
Would you characterize him as a phenomenon?
Oh, yeah. He's a phenomenon, yeah, sure.
When was the last time the four of you were together?
Must have been at least 3 or 4 years ago. I've been in America for 3 years. I don't think I've seen George over here once. That's 3 years ago. So it must be 3 or 4 years. Paul, Ringo, and I were in Los Angeles about 6 months ago together.
Mm-hmm.
Paul was in New York 3 months ago. I was in L.A. with Ringo 2 months ago. George is on his way over to start his tour. I'll go and see him, folks. And I'll probably see him before or after the tour. I'm almost thinking after, because he'll be so wound up before the tour.
Obviously, it's very difficult for you all to be together, even if only in the light of your own difficulties. And
well, yeah, because...
Going into and out of this country.
Yeah, because George and Paul also had a little problem with the dreaded devil weed. Mm-hmm. And they have trouble getting in and out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But if you apply eight months in advance, you might get in.
Do you think there's any possibility, giving way to the concession of possible legal clearances, of the four of you ever working together again?
Yeah, I think it's quite possible, because there'd be no reason not to. Now, whether we do live performances is another matter. That's a whole ball game. But it's quite feasible that we'd make records together, because I've worked with Ringo and George. The only one I haven't worked with since the breakup is Paul, and I've worked with Elton John, I've worked with Harry Nilsson, we all work with lots of other artists, so why not each other? It's quite possible.
There is a remaining and enduring affection between and among you.
Yeah, we went through a sort of divorce pangs period where we were all a bit uptight with each other. And I think it was mainly...
Why?
I think it was mainly, looking back on it, from my own part, it was mainly fear, even though I wanted the Beatles thing to end. Just, I felt as though I couldn't breathe if it went on any longer. And also it was sort of dying, you know?
Do you think it was smothering you individually?
Yeah, it was that, and we were no longer enjoying it. And all through it, we really did enjoy it. There were lots of messing and times we hated it, but basically we did it because we liked it. The rewards were as a sort of bonus. We wanted to be musicians, we liked working together. It got boring, and I think we went through a little trauma of divorce because of it was scary after being with people for 10 years suddenly to be out on your own. It's so cool saying, I want to leave you, to anybody that you've been with for a long time, and then suddenly you're out on your own. And I think we've all adjusted to that. We're all doing well with our records, so that makes us confident enough to relax about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've all established ourselves as individuals now. And so that's all over, and we are good friends. And whenever we meet, we spend a lot of time over a bottle of wine reminiscing. You know? Remember when we were in so-and-so, and that girl jumped on your head? Yeah, remember this, remember that. So
mm-hmm.
We're quite happy about it.
What have been your most recent works?
Walls and Bridges album out now.
Which you mentioned.
Well, did I mention that? Oh, yes. And there's a single from it out now, which is Whatever Gets You Through the Night, featuring Elton John on piano and vocal harmony. And I just finished that album. It took me 6 weeks, which is pretty good going. And I'm now back in the studio working with some tapes that I started in 73 with Phil Spector. And I'm just getting that ready for maybe January.
But you have complete individual confidence now, as you indicated in the earlier sentence.
Yeah. I think it was just that feeling of suddenly being on your own after having other people to lean on.
Mm-hmm.
We're all leaning on each other for a long time, and I think it was good that we separated, sort of found our way around a bit.
Now, you talked earlier about the music of the 60s. We are in the music of the 70s. How would you characterize that music differentially from the 60s?
Well, I think a seed was planted in the 50s by the early rock and rollers. It became a young tree in the 60s, and now it's sort of branching out into all different forms, but the seeds were already there in the 60s and the 50s. And now you're just getting variations. It's a bit like jazz. I although I don't know a lot about jazz, early jazz, I do know that it started out as one form. Then it got a little more diverse, a little more complicated. You've got your avant-garde, you've got your traditional, you've got your blues, you've got all these different fields of jazz, and I think that's what's happening to rock and roll. And it's almost killing it as well, because I think jazz got a little throttled by intellectualism. And
it's an interesting statement. You said it's almost killing it as well. I think jazz got a little throttled by intellectualism. Is that a vocal implication, that intellectualism is throttling contemporary music?
Yeah, I'm partly to blame myself as well. It's sometimes take too much thinking about the music and discussing it and not doing it. And I think it seems to happen to all forms of art or culture, even sport, not even sport, everything. What we seem to do is we have something, and then we refine it, and we refine it, and we refine it, till it's no longer resembling what it started out to be. And it has its own set following, but it loses some kind of natural spirit to it. And I think rock and roll has... that started a few years back, and it's still happening. I don't think it'll kill it for good. I think it's a kind of music that'll be around. There'll be jazz, there'll be rock and roll, there'll always be that kind of music, but I think it's in danger of taking itself too seriously.
What is your feeling about those who object to so many of the lyrics extant today?
I think I understand them, but most of us, quite a lot of us anyway, use four-letter words, you know. I know most men do. Usually they don't when women around, which is some kind of, it's hypocritical really, but it depends, you know, who the woman is. And I think that kind of thing is the same kind of thing that used to ban books. You know, words can't kill you. And people that banned words in books, it didn't stop people buying those books. The books were smuggled in. If you couldn't buy Henry Miller in the early 60s, you could go to Paris. In England, we used to go to Paris, and everybody would buy Henry Miller books because they were banned, and everybody saw them, all the students had them. And I think if there is a problem with lyrics and words of records, I think then they should have, like they do on TV, saying, on this show, this radio show, we're going to have a few lyrics that might upset people, so don't listen to this show. Because I think we should be able to express ourselves without, as long as we don't harm anybody. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe words can harm you.
You've fallen prey to those charges to some extent, haven't you?
Yeah, I had a record a few years back called Woman is the Nigger of the World. And a lot of stations wouldn't play it because they said their black listeners objected to the word nigger. But actually it was mainly white people that objected to it. You know, it's a sort of, it's a tricky psychology there. And of course now one could probably get away with it. This is only 3 years ago. And I have had a record with the word C-H-R-I-S-T, which we're still not allowed to say on there. They always say superstar for that film on the record, which is extraordinary. And words like that, you know, everyday words. And I think it's ridiculous, and it is changing, and nobody can stop it. It's like something that has to happen, and people are trying to hold it back, like trying to King Canute trying to hold back the tide.
I want to get back to your earlier discussion, which I found most interesting, this subject of throttling with intellectualism, because you threw in an almost parenthetical aside. You said, I myself am guilty of that. Hmm. How are you guilty of that?
Because there was a period, and I can't put my finger on it, when I was trying and thinking so hard about the music that it wasn't spontaneous anymore. It didn't have any life in it. I'm not saying it went on for a long period, but I found myself treating it differently from the way I treated it all my life, which mm-hmm. is just music, and I get into it and like it or don't like it. And I started looking at it too much as a quotes-unquotes art form, and even with the lyrics, and it was limiting what I could do. You know, I would say, well, I'm not going to use that cliche. I'm not going to use that cliche musically or lyrically because of this, that, and the other. And by the time I discussed it, I'd limited my whole range of composition about what I could use. I was becoming a musical snob, which I was always down on other people for being like that.
You feel you're out of that motif now?
Yeah, oh, definitely. You know?
How do you know?
Because I can feel it in the music and my attitude to it. I can also feel... If you hear my new album, Walls and Bridges, out now.
On an Apple Capital.
On an Apple Capital label in your local store. Yeah, I allowed myself to go in any direction I wanted, meaning it's a sort of hodgepodge of different kinds of music. And some of it's very poppy, some of it's bluesy, and there's no limit to it. I have not limited myself by trying to say, oh, I've done that before, therefore I won't do it. This has been done by so-and-so artist, therefore I won't do it. It's not original. I've just gone back to making music that I like.
All right, so you're not now involved with what you earlier termed a refinement and a re-refinement. What then can be your new contributions to the musical culture?
I think my greatest pleasure is writing a song, words and lyrics, that will last longer than a couple of years. And if I get one out of 20 or 30 songs that anybody could sing, from Frank Sinatra to Tiny Tim, then that's my greatest feeling, is to do one a piece of work like that. And that happens rarely. And
it happened in the case of the Beatles.
Yes, we got a few out. And I've done a few myself since we split up. Songs that'll outlive me, probably. And that gives me my greatest pleasure. And therefore, the musical style doesn't matter. The basic thing is still the song itself. And that's where I get my kicks.
That's where you get your kicks. That's the whole of your life, the fullness
of
your life.
Well, no, I mean, there is sex and fun, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But creatively, at the moment, it's still that feeling of always trying to make either the perfect record or the perfect song. And I know it's impossible, but that's the thing that keeps you going. I guess in sport it'd be the perfect play.
Do you think you can ever be happy in marriage?
The happy is a broad word. I don't think anybody can be totally happy in anything. I take happiness when it comes and the blues when it comes. And one of my old sort of sayings was, it's heaven and hell every day. And if I get a little light as well as the darkness, I'll go with that. It's taken me 34 years to work that out, you know. And I'm 34 next week or something like that. And marriage is no harder to be happy at than anything else. It's the same as life. So I don't really categorize it into marriage, career, or anything like that. If I'm happy, I'm happy either married, unmarried, hit record, no hit record. It sort of seems to have almost nothing to do with how your social life is going, your happiness.
You're an interesting man and already a proven genius in your field. I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you, Howard. So did I.
John,
see you in the football game, right?
Yes, indeed, at halftime in our Monday night booth.
Okay.
John Lennon has been the guest. The name of the show is Speaking of Everything. Howard Cosell, thank you for listening.
You're tuned in to Rossano Radio on WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM and live worldwide at WMFO.org.
Okay, I'm FR and I'm your host here at Rossano Radio. You just heard Number 9 Dream by John Lennon. Before that, we heard Howard Cosell interviewing John Lennon on his show Speaking of Everything back on October 6, 1974. Great interview. All right, want to get in touch with us or me? Go to RossanoRadio.com. You can also make a request there too. Okay, we'll get back to more songs with hooks right after this important message.
You are a waste. A loser. Everyone hates you. Why don't you just stay in your car and keep driving? I'm serious. Drive until you run out of gas, then get out of your car and walk until you find someone who doesn't think you're dumber than bricks. Could take a while, but at least all that walking might burn a couple of calories.
You may not witness bullying like this every day. Your kids do. They want to help, but they don't know how. Visit stopbullying.gov to learn safe, simple ways your child can help stop bullying. Be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Paul McCartney on behalf of Rad. If you're drinking, you can't drive my car or any car. Remember, if you're partying this holiday season, don't drink and drive. Got it? It's just not worth it. Doesn't make sense. Thank you. Yes, I'm
gonna be a star. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, Rad, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council. Beep, beep, yeah.
Tony Boy, backed only by accordion. Three rows of pale brunettes protect him from the crowd, and a curtain is a patchwork of imitation vermilion, and a red ball hangs over the throne that has been found. This is a scene on Main Street when John 50 comes to town. Yes, this is a scene on Main Street when John 50 comes to town.